a big tree is as much an ecosystem as a small plant or a planet. And when you're standing at the base of a big kauri or redwood, it's impossible to tell what's going on at the top. Dr. Meg Lohman is one of the world's first treetop scientists, and naturally is quite a climber. She's written a book called The Arbornaut about her work. She's a leader in the conservation movement. The National Geographic dubbed her the real life Lorax, and she pioneered the science of canopy ecology. She joins me from Vermont, I think, where the leaves must be turning, Meg. Hi, how are you?
I'm well, and yes, the leaves are turning, but I sure miss some of those Australian and New Zealand tall trees that you have down there.
Did you start studying the canopy when you were in Australia?
Yes. So really, Australia and your part of the world is the absolute birthplace of canopy science. We invented so many of the tools down there. So you need to pat yourself on the back.
And what tools did you develop?
Well, when I was a graduate student at the University of Sydney, I realized how tall those rainforest trees really were and that nobody ever saw the top except when foresters cut them down. So I created a slingshot as my first tool to propel a fish line and then haul a rope over a branch in a tree. And then I sewed a harness and I borrowed some caving gear from the caving club. And lo and behold, I put together a toolkit that allowed me to use ropes and slingshot to get into the treetop. So that was toolkit number one. And then when I realized I couldn't take a couple of people along with me, sometimes it's better to work as a group, I helped design the first canopy walkway up in Queensland at an ecotourist lodge. And so lo and behold, we had both these aerial walkways and the rope gadgets, all part of canopy science gear that was developed in Australia and also pioneered in Tasmania and New Zealand. So that was the real beginning of our exploration of the tops of trees.
Can you tell me how many canopy walkways that you're responsible for around the world now?
Probably about 30, and there exist about 60 or so. So other groups have taken up this excitement and enthusiasm, including some neat ones in national parks in Australia now. So it is becoming more and more an opportunity for people to really get excited about the whole tree, not just the forest floor. And don't forget that 50% of species on the planet live in the tops of trees. So it's a very cool place to go if you want to see wildlife.
You mean 50% of the species live in high trees and you can't find those species anywhere else?
Absolutely true. And most of them never go to the forest floor. We're talking birds, insects that pollinate the flowers, bugs that eat the leaves. Remember that all of that life and growth is going on at the top of the tree, not at the bottom. So it kind of makes sense to realize that the canopy is the real hotspot for life in the forest. And so many millions of things are up there.
Can you describe for me a canopy walkway? How does one work?
Sure. Oh my gosh. And you must go to one. They're so exciting. First of all, we have a couple ways of building them. A wonderful way is to go out from a hillside. So you just have a flat walk across a bridge. And sometimes we use poles to support them. Other times we use big tree trunks to delicately suspend the bridge. And the wonderful thing is you can just quietly walk. You can get eyeball to eyeball with the birds. You can see all kinds of mammals living in holes in the trees. You can, if you're a graduate student or even a high school student, do some research for your science project at school because you can get up close to all kinds of things that are living in the canopy. But it's a fabulous, wonderful way to really experience the wonders and excitement of the forest, which you really can't get on the forest floor, which sometimes has only 1% of light as compared to the top of the tree. So it really is a very fun and exciting activity, and I hope you'll find a walkway and go to it. I have a map on my website, canopymeg.com, where you can see all the locations, and maybe you can even take a fun journey and go to a very cool one in Samoa or Queensland or perhaps even the Amazon.
We have a photo of you on a canopy walkway in Peru on our webpage, and it's like it's a string bridge basically, and we might have those here but not call them canopy walkways. Do you know what I mean?
Sure, I do. And people have used them to connect villages or to cross steep mountain passes. But now we're using them in this special way, which is simply to access the tops of tall trees for purposes of education and research in particular.
When you started out in the 1980s working in Australia, you were working on the cause of the huge dieback of eucalypts. Did you find out what was causing it?
Yes, and I actually did work first in the wet tropical forests, and then I shifted to the dieback because of this extraordinary death of so many gum trees that occurred in Australia in the 1980s. And we knew in Western Australia it was caused by a fungus that affected the soil. We knew in South Australia there was some salinity entering into the soil, but we didn't know what was going on in New South Wales. And it turned out that it was indeed one specific insect called the Christmas beetle that really exploded in numbers in the canopies. And as the farmers cut down trees, it meant that the sheep gathered under the remaining trees. And when they peed into the soil, they put a lot of nitrogen there that caused the larvae of these beetles to really thrive. And then the beetles came out from the soil as adults and ate all the leaves and the remaining numbers of trees. So there was this amazing situation where fewer trees, more beetles, more attack on those remaining trees, and then death of the trees. So it was kind of a neat little puzzle to put together. And we created some tree planting projects and were able to get ahead of the beetles and give the farmers a chance to create healthy pasture lands, which was so, so important.
So in your experience, things kind of go along in a balanced way, but it only takes one change made to the ecosystem to throw it out of balance.
Absolutely. And I'm embarrassed to say that usually it's humans that do cause those changes. We're so, so absolutely determined to do things sometimes without thinking it through in the best of intentions. But in this case, yes, humans have made some changes to the planet. We've seen fires, we've seen deforestation, we've seen fragmentation of trees. Plots. And lo and behold, we're getting to a point where our poor trees can't survive anymore.
Clearly, climate change is an exacerbating issue.
Absolutely. And it's really devastating. And it is creating drier conditions and hotter conditions. And guess what? Insects love that. So they outbreak in the trees a little more frequently, killing the remaining trees. And so do the fires and so do the hot, dry conditions. And we need forests. Without trees, we literally cannot survive. Our children and grandchildren are under threat if we can't try to save trees on this beautiful planet of ours.
Tell me about the work that you're doing in Ethiopia, because it's an interesting mix of religion and science.
Yeah. And, you know, in my quest, after becoming a scientist that studied the trees and the biodiversity, I now dedicate the rest of my career to saving trees, because even in my own lifetime, half of the big trees in the world have been chopped down or burned or destroyed by humans. So I'm trying to work in countries that really, really need help, that have very little native forest left. And Ethiopia has less than 4% of its native forests in the northern half of the country. And those remaining trees happen to be in the churchyard, because the priests have been believers that they need to save all of God's creatures. And I, as a conservation biologist, feel that I need to save biodiversity. So I'm partnering with the priests. We've built up a lot of trust and friendship over many years. And now we're using that trust and friendship to actively build stone walls around these remaining forest patches, protecting the trees from being eaten by cattle and sheep, making a boundary so that the farmers respect it. And lo and behold, the people are so thrilled because they know they need those native trees to house their birds and their pollinators and their animals and every single native species in Ethiopia. So it's a really exciting project. There's a whole chapter in my book dedicated to that, because I think it's important in conservation to think about working with different kinds of people, not just throwing money at governments to try to save trees, but thinking about who are those real stewards of the forest and how can we work together.
It seems a very small part. You know, we get boggled by the planetary crisis. You must get a lot of satisfaction out of focusing on a small part of the world and really making a difference. But when you pan back, do you also get stricken a bit by despair?
I do all the time, but I give hundreds of school talks and I have to have hope because kids need us to have hope. And the last chapter of my book is devoted to a fairly big project where I'm ramping up the thought of the Amazon Walkway or the Ethiopia Forest Project. And I've identified the 10 most urgently need to be saved forests of the world because they have high biodiversity and dreadful deforestation. And I'm hoping to raise $10 million to build canopy walkways in those forests so that local people, especially women, can be hired as ecotourist operators. We save the trees and we save the biodiversity by creating this wonderful ecotourist operation. And lo and behold, people come there. And in the process, we can save this, what I call a genetic library. We can save enough of the native species of a country so that eventually restoration can occur. Because right now we're going against extinction. We have to save the last populations before it's too late. So I'm really excited about this project. We have 3 countries with success so far, Malaysia, and we're just about to embark on a walkway in Madagascar, and we've built the walkway in the Amazon, which is fabulous, but we're educating some women and creating some education units there. So stay tuned and read that last chapter first, maybe, because hopefully you will have hope when you hear about this action that we are undertaking at this point in time as Arbornauts.
People are telling me, of course, that we have treetop walks or canopy walkways in New Zealand, Wilton Bush, and in the Redwood Forest in Rotorua and in Hokitika. I guess I've never called them canopy walkways, but of course, that's exactly what they are if you're above the trees and you're looking down. What is your greatest area of concern or part of the world that you are most concerned about? I'm suspecting you're going to say Amazon, is it?
I will say the Amazon because right now it is, of course, called the lungs of the planet. It's the largest remaining tract of tropical forest. It does not mean that the forests of Australia or even of Indonesia are not so important to the people that live there and to the planet as a whole. But if we do lose that enormous tract of forest where there's so much gas exchange and so much rainfall coming and going from the trees to the air and back again, I think we really will see our poor little old planet struggle to survive. So we do need to protect these remaining large patches if we possibly can, but we still need to hire and employ the people that live there. We can't turn our backs, and we need to come up with innovative and creative ways to do that.
You have in your book compared a scientist learning about a tree from its trunk, making as much sense, comparing it to a doctor examining a patient by looking only at the big toe. Do you think that people are coming to understand that more now?
I do. You know, it's funny, I did make that analogy because I looked for 100 years, I read all the literature of foresters studying trees, and they always walked around the tree trunk, stayed on the forest floor, looked up 100, 200 feet high, never saw the top of the tree, but they drew their conclusions from that big toe of the tree. And I thought to myself, if my doctor did that about my whole body, I'm sure I would switch doctors. And by climbing trees in the last 20 or 30 years, that handful of us I call arbornauts have actually exposed these amazing new facts that 50% of species live up there, that a whole bunch of carbon is stored there, that we have this extraordinary gas exchange going on up there, and we have water being cleansed and filtered through the tree canopy. So I think by studying the whole tree and not just the base of the tree, we now know so much more about forests and their importance value.
How many new species have you found?
Probably hundreds, maybe thousands, but I don't spend my time naming them. I ship most of my discoveries to museums because the people who work in museums, called curators, are those experts that learn the science of describing new species, and I wouldn't have enough hours in the day to do all that description. But it's extraordinary to think if there's half of the species of the world live in the treetops, and only a handful of us are exploring those tops of trees, we kind of admit that probably about 90% of what lives up there has still never been classified or seen or identified. So it really is a race against time. And I would encourage all the young people that listen to your program to think about perhaps becoming an arbornaut when they grow up.
What are water bears?
Oh my gosh. There is a chapter in my book devoted to redwoods. Kids in wheelchairs whom I've worked with to help become arbornauts. Believe it or not, any group of young people can do whatever they want with a will and a little bit of innovation. So we've developed pulleys to get wheelchair-limited kids into the tops of trees. And to help them get excited about science, I partnered with a water bear scientist so that we could discover lots of new species, because this phylum, if you can believe it, a whole phylum of animals called tardigrada are little microscopic, cute as the dickens organisms that live in drops of water on surfaces of leaves, in moss, in bark, in lichen. So lo and behold, millions of these water bears live in the tops of trees. And one of the things that we've been doing is helping students get excited about treetop science by giving them the chance to discover and name new species. So what better group to start with than these cute little water bears? And they're the same organism, by the way, that went to the outer space and reproduced and came back, and that have been able to live in the bottom of hot springs and over in Antarctica and the ice flows. Animal Planet calls them the extremophile organism of the planet. So do Google water bears, and most fifth graders I find know what they are because they love studying really cool and weird things, and water bears definitely win the prize for that.
So essentially they're all over the place. They've learned to live everywhere, have they?
They absolutely are. I always tease people and say it's probably the commonest species in your backyard. And I hate to say it, but if you eat anything vegetable like lettuce or corn or maybe something like, you know, any kind of surface of a fruit or a vegetable, I am sure you are ingesting water bears and you just didn't even know it.
No, I didn't want to know that piece of information. Thank you. Tardigrada, is that what you call them? Tardigrada?
Yes, that's the scientific name of the phylum, but we call them water bears or tardigrades as a commoner name.
And the individual Randy Miller, whom you spoke about working with on the water bears, he has mobility issues as well, so this got you into making the canopies available to people who may be using wheelchairs.
Absolutely correct. And I have devoted a huge part of my career to more inclusivity in science, including girls, including people of different ethnic backgrounds. And I've always observed that almost no students with any kind of physical handicaps were ever welcomed or kind of given any opportunities in field biology. So that was something that I was really grateful to work on and have a partner who not only was a water bear expert, but had a nice empathy for that type of student himself. So we were a team for 5 years on that project, working every summer with different groups of students.
You've discussed, and in fact, you have a chapter in your book called Hitting the Glass Canopy. What was your experience?
Gosh, I have to say, and of course, I am, you know, not a spring chicken anymore. I'm in my 60s. But when I first started science way back in the 1970s, women were not welcome as foresters. I was the only girl at Duke University in the forestry classes. I was one of few women at Sydney University doing biological sciences. And I've had several chapters in my career where it was very obvious that women were not considered to be qualified to lead or to be promoted. And so part of my reason for writing this book was in hopes that other young women could read it and maybe benefit from what I call my misadventures. In other words, they could learn from things where I struggled and do better and be smarter and wiser than I ever was.
But you're not suggesting that what you met with was your fault, are you?
Well, I think I was too shy. I don't think I was aggressive enough. I never had women colleagues because there weren't any. So whether or not that's my fault, I don't know. Maybe I should have taken another career, but I did really want to pursue science. And I guess as with so many things in life, somebody has to go first. And I think there were a handful of us that were determined to do that. I was so often the only female in many field expeditions, but today I hope that the ratio has changed and somewhere, sometime, somebody has to change those trajectories. And so I'm really grateful that maybe it can be a little bit more improved for the next generation.
Do you think it has changed now?
I think it's changing, but I think women still need to be smarter and do things well and support each other so that they can continue to achieve more. It's still not equal, I think, in many ways to the male world. There have been plenty of studies that indicate women still don't get equal salaries and maybe they don't retire with the same amounts in their portfolios. So we still need to help young girls achieve, especially in the sciences.
Did you never suffer from vertigo?
What I would say is I had a mild fear. I was always so respectful of heights, but maybe that helped me become a better arbornaut, because if I had been too careless, I perhaps could have had some more serious issues befall me. So I guess having a little bit of respect for heights was probably a good thing.
You're urging people to become citizen scientists. Is it easy to do that?
You know, more and more, and by citizen science, I mean everybody can do something to contribute to our knowledge of what's outdoors. Some people love to take pictures of the flowers that are coming out along the sides of the road, or other people go bird watching. And now there are so many ways where you can download that information onto websites and help state parks or governments or universities collect information, everything from water quality to numbers of bees pollinating flowers. There's just a lot of ways increasingly that families can become part of surveying our wildlife. And that's a really great thing, because scientists can use that information and do a much better job at making discoveries, because 60 pairs of eyes is so much better than just one pair of eyes.
And you have to train people to see, right? Bioblitzes are quite a useful tool in that regard.
They are. And you're right about training them to see. You can't usually expect people to identify everything, but if you can get people to say, please tell us if you see a lady beetle, they will write in and go yes or no. And that's a really great little way to add data points to a map of lady beetle distributions. Or maybe you want to say, please tell us if you see wallabies, or please tell us this or that. And so it's really been a great opportunity to help expand science and probably to help people understand science a little better, which is really important in this world of ours.
You've also, it's not only ropes that you've used, you've have descended into canopies from air balloons and worked on inflatable rafts dangling from canopy cranes all over the world. That sounds quite difficult.
I know, I don't, my mother doesn't like
You
hearing
don't
about those
recommend
things
it, huh?
either. But I will say it was one of the most fun things I ever did was hanging out of a hot air balloon and visiting the very tops of trees, which is hard to get to in any other way. It was quite marvelous. And the construction crane is a device that is now used in about 10 forests around the world. It's fairly expensive in the budgets of most forest biology. It costs about $1 million to set one up, which is not expensive compared to outer space exploration, but unfortunately, it's expensive for most forest biologists. And those give you this incredible access to all the tree branches within the reach of the crane bucket. But it's limited because you can't take it to the next site. It's usually cemented into the ground by the time you use it. But again, this whole toolkit for studying the tops of trees is quite diverse now and gives us a chance to really focus on the health of the forest and what lives up there.
What's the most fascinating tree that you've been to the top of?
Gosh, I'm very partial, and there is a section in my book about fig trees. I love figs for a number of reasons. One is that they feed so many millions of animals. The fig fruit is fabulous in so many countries, from Australia to India to South America. They're very global in their distribution, and they're also quite amazing because some figs, which we call banyan trees or strangler figs, actually start life at the top. When the fig bird eats one of the fig fruits, it poops out the seeds in the branch of a tree, and lo and behold, the banyan tree sends roots down from the top and then has this extraordinary advantage over all the poor little seedlings that are struggling at the forest floor where it's really dark. And I always use that analogy when I'm talking to girls in science about being more strategic and thinking like a fig, where you can maybe take better advantage of local resources to have your place in the sun. And so the fig tree has been a personal inspiration to me, as well as a really fabulous member of the tropical forests.
I've never thought about the banyan tree being a fig tree. Does it produce edible figs?
Yes, in fact, all fig, ficus is the genus. Banyans and other kinds of fig do produce a fig. Now, some figs are fleshier and bigger, and you're much more aware of them than others. So that maybe is why you didn't see the actual figs themselves, but they sure do. And in many cases, they've, kept all sorts of populations alive.
You point out in your book that figs are not really fruits, but a cluster of hundreds of flowers enclosed in a smooth skin.
Isn't it amazing?
It is
And there's
amazing.
so many, technical parts of botany that we still don't know much about. And even more extraordinary is those little fig wasps go in to pollinate, and then they sometimes actually die inside of the fig fruit. So I hate to tell you this again, Kim, but you sometimes are eating a few little wasp wings when you're eating a fig, and I guess it gives you a little bit of extra nutrient, but nobody seems to complain because figs are so delicious.
Good to know. Actually, I might be the only person in the world who does not like fresh figs. I do not get them. I do not see the point.
Well, then you've spared from eating wasp wings.
Not the tourism aspect of the canopy walkways. My microphone was inadvertently turned off just then. Sorry. The tourism aspect, do you not worry that this may damage the environment?
That's a great question. I'm glad you asked that. And of course, there are two alternatives usually. We can build a canopy walkway and create this wonder about the forest in a solid ecotourism business that draws people to come to the woods. Or we can leave the forest alone, where it most likely will get clear cut and totally disappear. So The answer is yes, a walkway will do a little bit of damage, but trails on the forest floor are much more damaging to tree roots, to the monitoring and traveling of animals, and to the growth of seedlings. The aerial trails actually are probably less damaging because they go through the air and not trample the soil itself. So whenever we explore forests as tourists, as bird watchers, as scientists, we of course displace a few things along the way, but we have to look at the trade-offs, and hopefully the canopy walkways will engender so much love and I think protection for the forest, because as people learn to love nature, they want to save it as well. And that will make a big difference in the positive outcome.
It's a very pragmatic attitude.
Hopefully, we sure need to save our forests, and we need to save all those wonderful creatures living up there, because that's where we've obtained a lot of our medicines, in the canopy. And it's extraordinary to think about that. It's almost like an apothecary up there, and we need to take good care of it so that we don't lose those opportunities.
What do you say to people who say that the best care we could take of it would be to leave it alone?
Well, it's fantastic, and it's great when we can leave it alone. But, you know, at the end of the day, mostly rich countries can afford to leave it alone. And even though, even oftentimes they do not leave it alone, Australia was a great example of a fairly wealthy country that seemed intent upon cutting its rainforest down in the 1950s and 60s. If you can afford to set some aside, it's fantastic, but we do need to employ the people that live in the forests or live next to the forests. And if we can try to develop some ways to utilize the forest but not damage the forest significantly, then that might be the best compromise of all.
Somebody, a number of people actually have said, listening to you talking about the eucalyptus or gum tree dieback that you worked on in Australia, we have kauri dieback here. We're very worried about the fate of our enormous kauri trees. Do you have a view on that? Have you thought about that or looked at it?
You know, I haven't looked at the kauri dieback, but I think it's quite similar. And I was actually a farmer's wife in Australia when I worked on the dieback. So I was very much a part of the community that really cared about the trees and fixing it. And I think in the case of kauri, you have a similar situation where the populations are patchy and thinned. It certainly is not the distribution it was several hundred years ago. So you have these treasures, these senior citizens, and you want each and every one to survive. But with the warming and the drying around the edges of some of these patches, you do find insect pests and fungal attacks and many more enemies coming to find those trees. And it really is a very serious issue. And for you with the kauris, it's not easy to restore them. It's not as if you can plant some and expect in 50 years time to have beautiful giant kauris. So I just absolutely hope that we can work together as a planet to reverse climate change so that the temperatures don't exceed a tipping point for stands of trees like your kauris that are so precious.
Where are you off to next? Your travel must be a bit constrained at the moment.
It has been. It allowed me to finish the book, of course, and it allowed me to make a lot of engineering designs for these canopy walkways. But I'm just about to go to Madagascar, and we are planning a walkway there. Madagascar, like Ethiopia, has less than 4% of her native forest left, and many, many species found nowhere else around the world, like lemurs. So we're really, really excited. And the people there, many, many people need jobs, and they need ecotourism as an opportunity to keep their families healthy and make a living. So I'm hoping we will succeed at that next year. And you can read about it on my website called treefoundation.org. You can read a little more about it in that last chapter of the book. But that's my next destination. And my fingers are crossed that the borders will open up in the next few months so we can succeed at that forest conservation project in Madagascar.
Excellent to talk to you. Thank you. Meg Lohman, whose book is called The Arbonaut.